copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I guess, just briefly, my background is in youth pastoring, and then I kind of fell into academia from there. But I've also had, I guess, first degrees and training and a bit of a career in advertising, writing and production. So I kind of fell into the crazy world of... Is anyone else connected with advertising in this room? Yeah? Some of the brilliant and nutty people that, and sometimes both, that work in advertising world, I've enjoyed kind of dabbling there. And about... also Christian film production has grown out of that. And then about 5 years ago, I took a kind of a sabbatical, and I was in Russia doing on the team of a kind of a Billy Graham style mission, a great big, you know, stadium preacher, and loved it. And I had a lot of time in the afternoons to walk around and to think and pray and just kind of muse with no pressure on, and started to feel that some idiot needed to make a film series about apologetics, and I was very well qualified to be an idiot, and so I thought, and I just stuck my toe in the water to see what would happen. I went home and wrote a proposal and pitched certain generous Christians that I know, wealthy people, and got a funding for the first episode. They said, all right, go and make the first one. And that was about $150,000. So I thought, okay, that's clearly a bit of providence right there. And off we went and made our first film, which you can see on the internet. That's called The Big Question Site. And it's the one about the Albatross and the A380, talking about flight. And we had John Lennox in it. He very kindly agreed to be part of the film. And away it went. And so, to be honest with you, the first cut of that was a bit off. We went and did it, and we were so close to the material, and we cut the film. We took it to the audiences, and they kind of went, close, but no cigar. And I was like, oh, what? And the first cut, we tried to do too much. We packed in too much, and it was unclear. And it wasn't, you know, sometimes you need time just to really let things breathe and to just really get that clarity in there. And so we got this feedback back of people kind of saying, I kind of know what you're trying to say, but I didn't quite get it. And so we went for a recut. I phoned a friend who's an experienced producer, and very good at structure, which is always my challenge area. And he said, oh, here's the problem. Just tick, 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 tick. Take the things that you've already got and just rejig them a bit and just go for simplicity and clarity. Throw away a few things. And after that, we took it back to market, and I couldn't believe the difference. We used two research agencies, a market research and a social research agency, and said, please play our film to 600 mainstream Australians. It's a pretty secular country, like much of, I guess, Western Europe. And back came these results that just blew us away. We'd got it, apparently. So we took that back to the backer. And the backer had been very patient with us in the development process. One thing I think you need is understanding backers who are going to see that you'll make a few mistakes along the way. You won't get it right the first time. You'll fumble and drop the ball. But go again. And sometimes it's just in the redo that you get what you were trying to say. As part of that, I took a break. I went away for a couple of months and because I had another commitment, and then came back to it fresh and went, oh, of course. And after that, we're getting very good results. Similar on some of the other episodes that we've tested on audiences. And I think that teaches me that it takes a while to find your format. It takes a while to get the recipe right. And don't be embarrassed if you have to fiddle around and nearly there. Upsetting and painful though that process is, I think it's worth tweaking and tweaking and tweaking until you actually get it to a formula that that works. What I plan to do this morning is to just go through some war stories of the making of this series. As Lars indicated, it's almost finished. We hope by the end of the year to be done with the thing. It's been a big job. And like an idiot, I've agreed to be producer and director, which is kind of two roles. And it's if I could find a producer who was willing to, you know, to hook in and do it, I would happily unload the organisational side of being the producer. But I must say the learning curve has been very steep. In terms of a process, and by the way, I hope to leave plenty of time for question time at the end. I'd like you to be able to steer this session in the direction of your interests and just, you know, ask me what's your interest, comment, take it however you like. So the process, and I'm borrowing this from my friend Marcus Gillazo. He's an atheist that I met in film school. We were doing our masters in film together, and on the first night, someone mentioned God, something like that. I don't know how that happened, actually, in Australia. God doesn't get much of a mention. And he went on this tirade about God, and all this anger towards God came out. And he expressed himself so eloquently, I thought, man, I really like this guy. And we went out for just a chat afterwards with a few of the students. And I took a while, actually, to reveal that I was a Christian. I thought it's probably wise to build up a bit of capital in the bank before I then spend it. And so I took weeks and weeks, and we'd worked on some projects together and become friends. And then it came out. Someone mentioned church or someone, I forget how. And, oh, you're a God. Oh, there's a bit of prejudice there, but we got past that. Anyway, he's now a producer at a very high level. He's made some Grammy-winning projects and so on. And here's his overall process. So first of all, concept. So you're starting with research. And unashamedly, I think the first step in making a film, at least a documentary film, and probably fiction films as well, is just really good research on the topic. ELF has helped me heaps in that regard. Two, generating creative ideas. I guess for me it's gone like this. Research is where you go, I can see that I want to make a film about the argument from consciousness. And so you read up on that all that you can. And you go, all right, here's some of the features of it. Here's the guts of the argument. Here's what it's trying to say. You sit in good seminars on it. You think about it. You write print about it. But then you've got to ask yourself, well, how do I best express this? What's the best way to get this idea across to an audience? And for me, that works. Actually, I've done a bit of study into creativity and how creativity works. I don't know if you guys, some of you will probably be across that literature. People like a writer called Kao from Harvard, he's done some great stuff. And of course, De Bono as well. And a guy called Kao. And one of the things they say is that generating creative ideas is actually a matter of discipline. I kind of learned this in advertising. I worked as a creative director for a while. And the real creative directors are not the people with the fancy car and the oh-so-arty clothes. Good luck to them. They're the image ones. The ones I really admire are the ones who work in the boiler room, who do the hard work, and who are very methodical and humble about it, actually. There's one guy in particular I used to work with. He would sit down with the client and he would try to understand the client and he would try hard to get what they're trying to say so that he knew even better than they did what their message was. And he would sit there with the whiteboard, endless patience with a whole room full of clients as they argued about what their real advertising message should be, and he'd just be scratching his chin like a philosopher and going, okay, all right. And he'd summarise and he'd repeat and he'd check and then he'd come up with a basic concept. And then his process was actually very, very step by step. He would kind of go, okay, well, if you want to say that, maybe you could say it in this way. And he'd watch the room go, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Maybe you could say it like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's kind of the way that creativity worked for him. The other thing I do know about it is a lot of hard research goes into it, and then it's best to go and do something completely lazy. Sometimes my best work is done when I'm down in the park with the kids. Especially if I've been for a worship service in the morning and I'm spending the afternoon trying not to think about work, then some idea just pops unbidden into the back of your head and things have time to connect. And especially if you're getting enough sleep, which is rare, and fit, you hopefully your brain just starts to do its thing and suddenly you've got an idea. And for me, that can work in all kinds of bizarre ways. I mean, I wanted... So the argument from consciousness one, I kind of thought, okay, well, the best robotics in the world, this is not genius, it's just kind of a logical step. The best robotics people in the world are in Japan. That would be an exotic location for a film. It's somewhere I would like to go. It passes the gut check. You know, it's somewhere I'd be curious to go to. And so we went off there to Japan. The next thing, of course, is trying to find people who will talk to you. But we found a superb local producer in Japan who'd also worked with Top Gear and had a great reputation. And he got us into some of the best universities there, speaking to some of the biggest professors in artificial intelligence. Unashamedly, I use local producers wherever I go. Pay them every penny that they ask for because they're worth their weight in gold. And he got us in, and away we go. But so that was research driven. Sometimes it goes the other way. To be honest with you, and I know this tape could get out, I've always really wanted to go to Antarctica. And so I thought, in one of these films, I've got to go to Antarctica. I don't care for what reason. I've just got to go. And then I was reading Alistair McGrath's book, The Fine-Tuned Universe, where he has this whole chapter about the water molecule and how water and its chemistry drives all life in our bodies, all life in the animal world, all life in the plant world, and has this massive role in climate because water has these... I won't give you the lecture, but water has these properties of chemistry that allow it to absorb heat like almost no other chemical. And so water is the climate control agent around the world. And I didn't realize, I read more into it, that Antarctica is where all that happens. It's the biggest water flow in the world, that Southern Ocean. And then Antarctic bottom water goes down because it's so heavy, stays right at the bottom of the ocean. It trickles up sometimes as far as Scotland, right? And as it does, it causes cycles of oxygenation, and it also helps in the carbon cycle, sequestering all that carbon that we worry about down into the bottom of the ocean, where it then becomes consumed by plant and animal life down there. And if we didn't have that going on, we'd have massively more problems with carbon than we do. And so there's this whole big system going on, all based on the incredibly complex chemistry of good old boring water. And I never knew. And then suddenly it's obvious, isn't it? You know, if you're going to go to Antarctica, that's what you're going to talk about. And so it seems to me that the research and creative process is quirky. Sometimes it happens idea, application, where we go. Other times it happens kind of, I really want to go and do this, so what's my excuse? Oh, water, great, perfect, okay, good. And I would defend either way of thinking. Feel free to come at the process from either end, I guess. And you start with a concept, okay? Then you take the concept to a committee. I've been blessed to have financial backers who are just very open people. Oftentimes money people, accountants, bankers, love them. Oftentimes they think in very straight lines and very carefully, and it's a very defensive kind of attitude that they'll have. I've dealt with that too in the past, and you just have... I think what really gets your points with people like that is strength of concept. If you go in there with a concept... And sometimes that's risky. I remember going into a room and saying, look, I want to... I did a one-minute pitch. I said, in about a month, there's a porn convention going in Las Vegas. I want to take my pregnant wife and I want to do a film interviewing porn stars about their souls. And I was waiting for them to look at me like I'd just, you know, been for a brain operation or something. But they looked at me and they went, wow, that's never been done before. I was thinking that could be a bad thing or a good thing. I said, actually, that's a great idea. Yeah, do it. I said, well, I haven't got a script yet. I've just thought of it. Yeah, go for it. Yeah, just do it. So if you have people like that backing you, it's and these are not you know, easy to push people. These are people who I think have some pretty strong ideas themselves, and they'll certainly push back if they're not keen on a concept. I love this quote from the guy who invented the Porsche. Committees are by nature timid. Based on the premise of safety in numbers, content to survive rather than take risks and move independently ahead. Independence, then, has always been the attitude at Porsche. To do not what is expected, but to do what we feel is right. Committees lead to creations that have no soul, no clear identity. That is why no Porsche will ever be created by a committee, but by a handful of people who know what a Porsche is. I'm not claiming my film series is a Porsche. Far from it. But I think I have had the blessing of working with a few people who know what a Porsche is and who are not afraid. Some of the money we've gotten from church systems has come with some of that committee baggage attached to it. It's been a bit tough at times because the committee go, but oh, what if it fails and what if it... You kind of get that negative defensive attitude. And I think, I don't know how you get past that. You just somehow, I guess, strength of concept... And the blessing of God working in spite of that sometimes. But I guess my point is you need around you a bunch of people that you can have sounding boards, people who can, I've got this idea for, and they can look at you and go, yeah, it's partially good. My wife is a legend for that. I'll come home with 35 fantastic ideas and she'll go, yeah, that one's not going to work, is it? But that one could, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I think that's part of the concept generation stage. So that's concept. Development, obviously, is refining the idea. And life just does that to you. I find that it's great to dream up these ideas, but then, especially when you're the producer, in my case, you have to go and actually make them work then. And that's the test. And it's when you start, I guess ideally you'd start with interviews of experts. You'd go out and say, here's the idea for the script. I'm going to go out and interview all the experts on this that I can and get the basic spine of the structure of the argument together, the basic outline of the film. And then that will refine it itself. And I must admit to you, some things I thought I was going to do when I go and interview the expert in this, when I go and interview Alistair McGrath, for example, on water, I find out I was wrong, or my research was wrong, or he doesn't agree with that concept, and I have to bury it. But often, also what happens is they say other things that you weren't expecting, and you go, whoa, there's an offer. And they send you down new paths and into new kind of areas of thought, which is cool. So the classical old way of making a documentary, you start with those interviews, and then you go and get the story. I actually think there's a lot of wisdom in that, because it helps you refine the idea. Selecting key personnel. That's always tricky, isn't it? When you're dealing with creative people, it's it can get all about ego. It can get all about, I'm the director and you're not, so shut up, don't say any ideas. I'm the one who's... Some of you are giving me funny little smiles here. But it just is. And I think, look, sometimes in the past I've just had to work with people where the chemistry is not that great. People I would regard as a little bit prima donna. Maybe they'd regard me as that too. I don't know. You never know if it's your own stuff. But this time I've had the chance to select the personnel I want to work with, which is, it's a godsend. My first director of photography was great, just so easy to work with, and the chemistry is there. I would just say, don't be ashamed to make those decisions based on your gut, and based on who you get on with and who you don't, because there's no virtue in working with a team where it's always awkward. And even if you're a gracious Christian or a Mahatma Gandhi, and you know you're happy to love your enemies and be patient with people, I'd say as much as you can, don't bother. Work with people where it's easy. Then you can put all your energy and attention into doing the job, instead of, oh, I hope I haven't said this the wrong way. And the team I've got now too, the two young brothers who work with me, just couldn't ask for better. They get up early in the morning saying, how can we do this better? They're motivated. They are constantly learning and pushing themselves up the learning curve, and that's the kind of people that you need. Sometimes when I'm tired, I'll say, I will just do this, and they'll say, no, we won't. We'll go the extra step, and we'll do this and this and this. I'm like, boys, I've had you up since 5 a.m. No, that's fine, bro. And when you're out on a shoot with these guys, that's just such a virtue. They don't complain. They work their tails off. They are just as motivated as I am to put the extra time in. And I remember the first time I said to them, we're going to have to get up at 3 o'clock to get there for the golden light. And they're like, that's fine, no problem. Better go to bed now then. I was like, I think I've found my crew. Those are the, I guess, selecting key personnel as much as you can. Financing, we talked a bit about that. I have no genius to offer there. Just really go and ask people with money and pitch them on a great idea and get a whole lot of knockbacks and just laugh and move on to the next one. That's really all I can say about that. And if somebody says no to you, it may not be that your idea is stupid. It may just be that they don't get it, or that they don't have the money right now, or that that's not their interest, or all of that stuff. D, pre-production. Planning the shoot. I write that there. You know, there's an old Yiddish proverb that says, we plan, God laughs. And it's very, very true in filmmaking, I find. We plan, God laughs. We constantly joke about the invisible producer doing his thing in our in our shoots. And trust me, we do our best to pre-plan everything. We, as much as we humanly can, we find out as much as we can about locations and things, try to get pictures of them and plan the light and plan the shoot and all that stuff. And then time and chance happens to all, right? And it all just goes out the window. Oftentimes you turn up and you've got this immaculately planned and there's some bureaucrat standing there saying, you cannot film here. Or, you know, you're constantly, constantly blocked. And I think, to be honest with you, even more than pre-planning, although that's important, the ability to think on your feet and to be resilient and to bounce with the punches and somehow get one back is the biggest part of the production game. It really is. I could give you a million examples. I'll give you a positive example. We turn up to Moscow to film. Have any of you seen The Stars, the film we showed last night and two nights ago? Some of you have been to? Most not? I should show you a few frames later. I'll show you 5 minutes of it at the beginning, maybe, at the end. So we're making this film, and we pitch up into Moscow, and we found out about this space museum in the center of Moscow there. We're going to go there and film, and we've got permission, and our local fixer has arranged it and everything, and that's great. And then he says, why aren't you filming at the other museum? We're like, okay, what other museum? Didn't know it was there. I says, oh, I'll get you in on Sunday morning when there's nobody there. I was like, okay. And so we pitch into this whole new museum, and I've got to tell you, probably 30% of the Russian segment of that film was made in that museum with no research, with no preparation. We just didn't know about it. It didn't appear in the guidebook we read, so we just had no idea. And we pitched up, and we had, I think it was 4 hours to shoot all these scenes in there. And so there's Yuri Gagarin's space capsule sitting in the corner. And there's all these rockets that have actually, or the copies of rockets, capsules that have actually been to Mars and been here. And I'm going, oh, this is such a good find. And we'd done good research. We'd put months into the research of that show. And then here comes a gift like this. And so what we had to do was just literally, okay, go up and read the plate on the thing, talk to the museum attendant and say, right, this is the Venera capsule that went to Venus, or the other one did. This is the spare copy. Okay, what do we know about that? Bang. All right, quickly write a soundbite, turn around, set up to the camera, bang, down the barrel. Months of script writing out the window. We're now ad-libbing. And it turned out, I think, pretty well. It was much better than the other museum we'd found that we had known about. And you get those kind of gifts. The negative side, we went to Iran. We're making a film about messianic prophecy. And so, of course, the Daniel 9 prediction of Messiah gets a look in. And we wanted to go to the places mentioned in the text, the places where Daniel had worked and prophesied and so on. And so we, all sorts of insurance dramas and all sorts of questions from the back as we finally got the okay to head into Iran and northern Iraq. And we'd bought a copter because we were visualizing doing a whole lot of great aerial footage of these places. And we got into the airport in Tehran, and this guy on the thing x-rays our bags and he says, what's in this box? I'm like, please God, it's our broadcast helicopter for filmmaking. He's like, no. And so for hours we're in the back room with him, and it turns out it's completely illegal to bring copters into the country, which we knew actually. But they got us, and they just said, okay, that cannot go in. We're going to keep it here for the 10 days until you come back. And I just felt my whole world come crashing down, because that was the whole basis of the shoot. So, and I knew that. I knew that there would be trouble. We were taking a big risk. I'm glad they didn't try and confiscate it, so we actually got away pretty light. But frankly, without sounding dodgy, you have to take those kind of punts sometimes. You have to just try and get past, because oftentimes it works. Oftentimes you do. There's a lot of countries where it's technically illegal to fly a broadcast helicopter, where we've flown a broadcast helicopter and nobody has cared. So that was gone. So then, all right, we're down to land-based cameras. All right, we just have to make it work. And I've got to say, from a crew, they bounced back from that disappointment so quickly. And they said, okay, we'll just go everywhere at dawn and we'll get time-lapse instead. And so we have. You should see that. I can't wait to play it to you. We've got these time lapses where it starts from, you know, dark and just whoosh, the colours come up and the camera slowly moves through that whole time lapse. And it looks, it's heart-stoppingly good. But the boys basically made up those sequences on the run because the ones we dreamed of all fell over. And sadly, that's kind of part of the game. Planning the shoot. Equipment. Yeah, I I probably won't go into much detail on that. I just say buy the best you can afford, look after it, or hire it if hiring is more rational from where you are. And recognise it's always a risk. We bought a helicopter and got it into Israel. That was a win. We nearly got stopped at the border. But then they looked at my passport, I think, and said, oh, Australians are pretty harmless and stupid and wouldn't hurt anybody. And so they let us come in. Also remember the fact that we'd fought for them in World War I, and we were the first nation to vote for the State of Israel at the UN. So I guess that gives us some points. And we went in, and I'm sad to tell you, we went down to Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, and the copter had been performing beautifully. We got it up to Matsada, you know, the big beautiful stone fortress up there. And the footage from that just stops your heart beating. You know, in comes this copter over the... And they very kindly closed the whole complex for us. They said, come in at 4 o'clock when all the tourists have gone and we'll just let you have free access. And again, the virtues of a good local fixer. And so we've got this footage of just, you know, swooping across as the sun's behind and just seeing this massive rock. And the copter was working great. Then we went down to Qumran and... my son and I, the presenters, we're walking up this hill towards the main cave, and then we hear this from behind us, and the copter's just done a somersault and developed a mind of its own. It's like somebody cast demons out of the pigs into the copter, and it's and they can see the pilot fighting for altitude, you know, oh, I'll try to buy some time, and then it just took off full speed across the landscape. We're going, ah! So the whole crew just dropped everything and rushed off after it, and took us an hour and a half to find the copter, and it was in about 4,000 pieces. So, and you just go, okay. And you've just got to be really philosophical, because we got to the crash site, and there's this bit of a tree. It's obviously clipped a little low tree and hit the site, and then there's this V-shaped trail of just wreckage and $20,000. First question, where's the chip? Have we got the card from the camera? So we've still got the footage. Yes, we do. That took us another few minutes to find. Next question. Okay, and my inner accountant is going, well, you know what? We've flown this copter 40 days. We've gotten 40 days of work out of it. And to hire a copter costs $3,000 a day. So we've gotten 40 times 3. We've got $120,000 worth of filming out of this. $20,000 is just blown up. But you've got to put it in perspective. It is a risky thing. And you've just got to, when you want to kick the nearest rock, you've just got to go, okay, that's just part of risk, just part of the way that it's going to happen. There's going to be some breakage, there's going to be some problems. And it's funny, you know, because our Jewish fixer, a local guy, he's an atheist since the Holocaust, right? He's not a believer in, you know, how can there be a God? And he watched all that happen. He watched $20,000 go down the drain. And he said to us the next day, he said, why were you guys so patient? Why were you guys so under pressure? I said, well, we try to be philosophical. And he said to the crew about me, and he said to me about the crew, he said, is this something to do with your faith, you guys? Is this something to do with, like, your trust in God? And I'm going, I hope so. I didn't feel particularly trusting at the time, to be quite honest with you. But he noticed that in the crew and somehow in me, that, you know, a disaster happens and you don't just lose everything. He said, I've seen those things happen to crews in the past. And they start fighting each other. They get drunk. They start blaming. They get really aggressive. And I was really proud of the way that the gang reacted. But I'm off the point. The point is equipment. It's going to break. There's going to be tragedy. I guess the point is minimizing that as much as you can. Production. What can I meaningfully tell you about the production process? Just that it's fraught with risk and stress and tension. That it's pretty taxing. We went into India, again with the Jolly Helicopter. We're doing a film about St. Thomas, who's the patron saint, I guess, of Indians. They love the guy because... Do you know this story? In about AD... When is it? I've forgotten the date now. That's terrible. He goes there. He goes to India. He starts on the west coast, and this blows me away. We went to a synagogue down on the west coast in Kerala. And here's a Jewish synagogue that's been there for hundreds of years, and they say it was there since about 900 BC. There's been a synagogue on that site because Jews were there for the spice trade. And it's this gorgeous harbour area. So we put the helicopter up, and the copter is filming Marcus and me as we go across on this old boat across the harbour. And my wife came on that trip with us, just because we needed extra hands. The crew and my wife were up in this old deserted building on the dockside, controlling the copter, and she was kind of, you know, keeping an eye on things for them. The presenters, Marcus and I, were out on the boat, and I get this message over the walkie-talkie from the sound recordist, and he says, oh, actually, they go off the radio for quite a long time, and I can't get them. I go, guys, are you there? Are you there? Are you there? And then I get this urgent message. He says, Gren, we've just been arrested by the police. We're in the back of the paddy wagon. They're about to take our radio away. They are not joking. This is serious. Oh, perfect. So we had this wise old Indian pastor with us, kind of as our cultural advisor, and he's instantly gets on his phone thinking, what's he doing? I'm praying. I said, I'm going to run across to the police and start talking. Jumped back on the boat, went across to where they were, found the police station, went in, and sure enough, they're talking about locking them up, and the charge is spying, espionage. We're like, what? Yep, you were flying a helicopter, and it's right near our biggest naval base. And they're saying, you must be Pakistani spies. I'm going, well, that's correct, except for two things. Number one, I'm not Pakistani, and number one, I'm not a spy. We talked with them and so forth, and they were very, very serious. And here's the other thing. Can I tell you this I know there's a camera there, but in some kind of confidence, the chip containing all the beautiful footage of that, my wife had taken it because she knew what was going to happen. They were going to confiscate it, and she'd taken it and stuck it in a bra. And there was a lot of questioning. What happened to the chip? What happened to the chip? And she just wasn't saying a word. Love that stubborn woman. She just wasn't gonna say a thing. And so then it was really aggressive for a couple of hours. They were cross-questioning us and treating us like spies. We just kind of try not to laugh because it's spies. Are you kidding me? I said, look, Google me on the internet. You'll find that we're a Christian film. Oh, that could be a cover story. Well, it's a pretty elaborate cover story. Anyway, so eventually the deputy state police commissioner comes in and he says, Kent, come outside with me. I'm thinking, I've heard about this. This is where you get, you know. But anyway, I went outside with the guy. And he says to me, are you a Christian? I'm thinking, do I want to admit this in a country where it may not be to my advantage? And I thought, I can't lie. So I said, yes, I am. He goes, are you a minister? And I'm thinking, oh, no, I'm about to bring big shame on the gospel here. He's going to say, well, you should know better. You should keep the law. And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, did you speak at a Christian school about 2 weeks ago? I'm like, yes. Did you tell a story about a dog? I'm going, yes. And he says, my two daughters very much enjoyed it. I'm going, oh, right. And it turns out his two daughters go to this Christian school where I'd happen to just pop in and take a worship in the morning. And he believed my story. He said to me, I know who you are. It's all right. I know who you are. It'll take about another hour and a half. The Navy experts will want to come and interrogate you, and they'll want to check your equipment to make sure that you haven't got any pictures. But it'll be okay, and I'll be here in the other office. So it's fine. And I was like, oh, yes, great. Thank you, God. Went back into the room, said to the team, it's going to be okay. And they were like, how do you know? I said, it's going to be okay. Can't tell you now. Anyway, long story short, we got out of there with no dramas. And the pictures look really, really good. That's the kind of rubbish that you put up. And that's a bit of an atypical story, but that's the kind of stuff that you put up with every day on a film shoot. Bureaucracy saying, no, you can't film here. But we paid for that. No, but that's... We tried to get permission months before. No, but that's for... You can't... No. But here's our paperwork. No. And to be honest, you have to develop a bit of a thick skin and the ability just to blag your way in anywhere. And if there's a sign that says, don't enter, every producer knows that's a sign that says, enter. Right? You just have to be a bit like that. Hopefully not unethically, but you just have to somehow keep bashing away and get the shot you need. Production. And the thing about production is it's kind of an ad-libbing game. You've got the script in your pocket. You try to be as faithful to that as you can. But then either something goes wrong or you get a better offer. And you have to have that ability to be able to ad-lib and to try a new thing. And I guess you have to have such chemistry with a crew that you can all get that. And then if the leader says, we're going to do this now, Or if the crew suggests, hey, what about if we do that? Then the whole team goes, right, great, love it, bang, and just moves. And when you've got a crew like that, which I do at the moment, it is heaven. And when you don't, it's constant diplomacy and constant emotional massage and constant looking after the egos of princesses and that kind of thing. And if you have to do that, you have to do that. It's part of the game. Post-production, that's where the film is really made, I think, because you come back with a whole lot of footage different from what you thought you were going to get, and you go into the edit room, and you work with the editors to try to come up with the best possible with what you've got. Close to the script or better than the script. And it's a... I love editors. They're real details people. The first one I worked with was a girl with a... she was a Cambridge grad. She was just so smart. She'd watch 40 hours of footage, take a few notes, maybe a couple of pages of notes, and she'd just remember where everything was. Unbelievable, almost photographic memory. And I'd say to her, we just need a shot of a blah. And she'd go, oh, I think here, under there it is. And she'd pull it up, and she'd go, how about this? You'd go, how do you remember this stuff? Editors are a special breed. I mean, they sit in those dark rooms 8, 10, 12 hours a day, and away they slog. And I kind of come in and out of the room and try to interact with them and say, okay, we're after this. Okay, good, yep. And it's a game of offers, I guess. It's a game of I'll say, is there any way that we could do this and this and this? And they'll say, okay, I'll try and do that as best we can. Or they'll say, hey, I thought maybe we could have this sequence to go that way. And as a director, I either go, yeah, that'll work fantastically well, or yes, but can we do this? Or sometimes, occasionally, thanks for the offer, but that probably won't work on this one. Could we do this instead? So it's a very negotiated, teamworky kind of thing, I find. And again, it comes down to trust in the editor and chemistry with the person that that you want to work with. Music, quite frankly, is in some ways the toughest thing. You'd be the judge of whether you think we got our music right on this film, but it's just such a slow process going. The emotion I'm after is this. We've been lucky enough to work with a composer, and in theory that should be easy, right? You should be able to say, I'm after this emotion, I want a really rocked up track here, but then I want it to ease off at this point, then I want it to hit it again right at this mark. But it's very tough to communicate about music. Maybe I'm just dumb at that. But it's that old saying, isn't it? You know, that talking about music is like dancing about architecture. You know? What does that actually mean? And I can tell you I want this and this and this, and the composer will go, oh, I thought you meant that. I'll go, no, I meant that. Well, I heard you say that. And it can pretty soon degenerate. I don't know any answers to that. I'm just highlighting that it's a tough thing to try to do. Marketing distribution, we haven't actually done that, and to be honest with you, that's not my area of expertise at all. I'm just going to try and keep an eye on it when that happens and try to find the right person. H, developing fresh ideas and beginning again. That's the bit I find so easy. I'll be out on a shoot and you'll be travelling to get there, you'll be meeting interesting people, and in every interview, in every location, there's 10 other things that could have happened. There's 10 other great ideas just sitting there waiting to be picked up and pressed into service. I'll die with about 4 bazillion possible film concepts in the back of my head that I'll never have time to make. And in a way, that drives me nuts, because there are so many great films that you could go and do. In another way, it's great because you the very act of going and making a film, I think, hands you a whole lot of other ideas. And the more you just read and try to think around what you're doing, I find that kind of the easy part. Testing those ideas is where I need other people to come in and be a bit more objective. So that's in some ways the cycle. This is a quote I love from George Miller. He says, once you've got it to 80%, in order to achieve the next 10% of excellence, you have to double that effort again. So to get from 80 to 10, you double it. Then if you want to go the next 5%, you have to double all that again. That's 4 times as much, if my math is correct. And I found that to be true. You know, you can bang out an okay, mediocre product quickly. But if you really want to step it up, it's, I find, and to be honest with you, I'm probably pretty slow at this stuff. I'm probably pretty slow and fussy. That's why we didn't screen the Baby Baby film, which I'd advertised here, because it wasn't quite right. We're going to put a bit more work into it and try to tweak it up a bit. But having made that mistake the first time, having put out a film there that the market just went, that knocked me around so badly, I don't mind telling you, that I thought, I'm never going to do that one again. And so I'll only show roughs to filmmakers, to producers, whose opinion I want. I'll never screen a rough to an audience. And that's a point. It's become kind of a point of pride and probably self-protection after that kind of process, to be quite honest. Alrighty, so look, there's much more I could probably say, but maybe you might have comments or questions. Actually, maybe we'll take a couple of minutes too. Meanwhile, comments or questions you'd like to make? Yeah, I guess I've got a few opinions, and let me see what you think of them. One would be that it's really tough for Christian media to escape sermonic modes. We love the sermon. I love the sermon. I preach. I love good preaching. I love what John Lennox is doing, but filmmaking is different. It's not just for a talking head. It's a visual medium, and it really should be driven by the vision. I'll show you a bit of the Stars film, if you like. We'll just screen a few minutes, and you'll kind of get a flavour of what we're trying to do in this series.
Blast into outer space. He was quoted as saying, "I didn't see God up there." Since then, space research has revealed hundreds of factors that had to go exactly right for life on Earth, and even for the universe itself to exist. Don't you wonder why? Were we just astronomically lucky to be here at all? Or was a great mind involved? Now there's a big, big question. We'll play around with gravity. Too much and too little. We'll look through radio telescopes at the masterpiece and talk to stargazers, some who think there is no God.
In the beginning there was nothing, and something came from it. There's a long story that tells you how, and I wrote down.
And some who think this fine-tuning shows a great mind.
Way too many things went right for this just to be attributed to chance.
Forget Jesus, the stars died so you'd be born.
Some say we're accidents in a universe born by chance. Some say we have a heavenly parent. I know which story is more comforting, but which one's intellectually honest? And what can I tell my children? I'm Grenville Kent, a Christian academic, and the new atheists have got me questioning my faith. So I'm going wherever the questions take me, bringing my ever-curious son, Marcus, and talking with leading thinkers on both sides of the God question. Because I really want the evidence. Is there a God? And will I ever find a hat that fits?
That gives you an idea of kind of what we're trying to do. We muck around with it a bit, and you know, it's one thing to have a lecture on fine-tuning in the universe, and that's interesting. I love that. But we try to make television of it. You know, try to... I guess the simple adage is show, don't tell. Show, don't tell. Or if you have to tell a little bit, just mix it up with a whole lot of showing. And or as an old boxer, my old uncle used to tell me in boxing training, one in the eye is worth two in the ear. I think that's probably the way I think about television, that a punch in the eye is worth two in the ear. And so we try to, you know, show you what gravity, too much gravity is like, then we go into a weightless tank and that kind of thing. And I guess for me, the weapon in apologetics that we don't use enough is curiosity. I find with preaching, I want to tell you everything and just close things down and answer all your questions. And it's probably dumb. I probably should be trying to raise your curiosity and get you asking a bazillion more questions. Not that there's not a role for obviously answering, but also just trying to keep the curiosity alive. And I think too, if Christianity has the image of being pretty dowdy and serious and dreary, maybe just the odd touch of humour here and there doesn't hurt in terms of keeping... Because You know, this is the God who made the platypus and the wombat and my kids, who are even funnier. And I just feel like sometimes it represents him well to show the funny side of things. There's something about a bit of humour that hopefully puts things in proportion. So those are some of the probably fairly simple ideas that that drive our thinking. Did you have a comment or a question you'd like to raise? It's a very small team. We've tried to keep overheads low. Camera and sound. The camera guy helps with... He does the lights as well, so he's the director of photography. And a sound guy is often our second shooter. So we take a very small team and we work them hard. And we come home after 3 weeks and fall in a heap and recover. Editors are back home cutting away. Yep. Yeah, editor's different. And we'll often pull in locals. Like in Russia, we had a local guide / producer who was a very good organizer, a very good, let's be honest, a very good giver of gratuities and bribes and spasiba, spasiba. And he was great. And he knows the culture because we would make idiots of ourselves. We don't have a clue what's going on or who we need to pay or whatever. And so we always have a local fixer. And we'll sometimes pick up a local production assistant as well if we need help carrying things or getting through things. It often really helps. In India, we had a wise old pastor was actually our local fixer. He was highly organized and wonderfully connected with government and everybody. He was kind of his church's liaison, government liaison guy. And he was just the most diplomatic person. But we also found a young Hindu guy was helpful in contacting Hindus. So whenever we were dealing with a Hindu, we sent in the Hindu to work for us. And he was, again, so the Hindu guy would go in and do all those relations, and he was the calmest man I've ever met. He would just walk in and there'd be India. I love it, but it's a crazy country. Everything's going nuts. And he'd just walk in, just be calm to everybody, and he'd sort it out in no time and we'd be on our way. So that's really valuable.
If you would be willing to come our university and also at the group of Christians who are doing television and who are trying to get trained.
Where are you?
I'm Cluj, Romania.
Oh, Cluj, yeah, no, I'd love to. That'd be great fun. In fact, I'm going to Romania in October, I think. Don't know yet. I'm just going on a speaking tour for somebody. Yeah. Great questions. Okay, first question, who's on the team? That's been the hardest thing, finding the right team, because, to be honest, the industry is full of princesses who may have big egos but don't want to work hard. I'm just being very honest with you. I just don't find that, you know, and you want the sort of people who'll travel with you for 3 weeks on end and still be your friends at the end. You won't believe me when I say this, but I've never had a conflict with this crew, never. We've disagreed on things, but I've never had or anyone get in a bad mood. They're just fantastic people to work with, and I finally found my dream team, to be honest with you. And
I'll stick together for all projects.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Once you get a team like that, you marry them. You never let them get away. Not quite, but you know what I'm saying. And as for your second question, my honest answer is I don't know. I'm looking for distribution because I realise that's a weak area in my own knowledge and all that stuff. And I'm talking to people here and saying, who do you know? And I've got a few leads out of ELF, which is great. But the difference is most distributors want their cut of 20% of the budget. I don't want to sell this film series. I want to give it away. Because my backers have basically said, here's $2 million, go and make a good Christian film series, and then give it away. Which is, I love them for that. It's a very generous funding model. I guess what I'm trying to say is if some mission organization in Romania, for example, in fact, one's already spoken to me, wants to have this for their purposes and give out 1,000 of them on campus or something, I don't want to make a buck out of it. But I think you're right. There's got to be an established value.
What are you doing of getting it out to more languages?
Right. What am I doing for other languages? Two options exist. One, just simply subtitle it on the screen and so that people could... Because a lot of people understand kind of English and with enough help, they'll get it. That's one cheap... Very cheap way to do it. All you do is, I've got a full script. You just translate that. Aware of timing. It's not as easy as it sounds. You know, sometimes English will say something really quickly, whereas other languages won't. Or English will, I might waffle on a bit and you'll think, how do I fill that space, you know? But anyway, once you've got the timing right, you can cut and paste those lines from the script over each scene. It's tricky because there are often subtitles already at the bottom and you don't want to get up too far or you're blocking the action, blah, blah, blah. But those things aside, subtitling's easy. The really tricky one is revoicing. And the big markets, Brazilian Portuguese, I think Spanish, someone from France and Germany have spoken to us already. They want to revoice it. And I'll basically end up seeing myself speaking in Portuguese because they will take the script and again, meticulously time their translation, and then they'll get an actor in. And some of the actors, in fact, the Italians are the best at this. Some of the actors can just follow my lips in their language. Seriously, they'll just watch it a few times over a week, and they'll come into the studio. I've seen this happen, and they'll go in the same pace as well. I've had to do that. When we went to New Zealand in the first film, some of the audio came back rubbish, and I actually had to go in and do what they call ADR, additional dialogue replacement. And it's tough. I'm not trained in that. And so I'm sitting working with the guy in the booth, and he's going, okay, watch your lips. And this is me. I'm doing it to myself, and it's hard, you know. I'm like, oh, I didn't go, the time's wrong. And, you know, so it's a complicated art. They've got software, though, that where he can actually shift it a bit to fit, and I mean, it's unbelievable what they can do. So those are two options, and I'm happy for organisations to do that as long as they do it at a quality standard that you're not embarrassed by. I remember going to a particular country and watching a disaster movie where women and men are screaming and running around, and it's translated by one guy in a boring voice, and he's going, oh, okay, run, you know, okay, now get in the car. Yeah, other comments, questions? Do I have an editor that works with a director? I did use a post-production director one time to help the editor in the first film, but I hated it. To be honest with you, I'm a control freak. I want this film to come out how I want this film to come out. That doesn't mean that I won't accept great offers and ideas from other people. I think I'm pretty collaborative to work with. I hope I am. But I'm going to have the final say on all the details, and it's going to be this. I mean, that's just how most directors I know are a bit like that. Can make us annoying to live with, but that's part of the game. And I think I've been too hands-on probably in this first series. Another time, I'll try to get a producer under me, and it'll happen faster, and I'll try to get an editor. In fact, I've found an awesome editor in the US, but it doesn't matter because I can send him stuff down the wire or mail him a drive in 3 days, and we can Skype, and he can show me the screen, and it's almost like he's in the same city. I love handing things off to a good editor, and they come back to me, but then I'll have the final cut on it. Yeah, that's a confession of being a bit of an edit Nazi.
How you minimize the number of people involved in producing?
If you look at my credits page, there's a few people there, mostly credits for footage and that kind of thing. I mean, yeah, we have local fixers, we have local producers that help us, but it's pretty much a small team. And I like that because a big team, I've certainly worked on productions with a crew of 15, for example, and that so much of your time is spent tripping over things and communicating with each other. No, what I meant was this and this and this. I guess I'm just a small business guy by nature. Here we go. So there's the credits, presenters, interviewees, two DOPs. They're the brothers that I've discovered, the Wachowski brothers, the Warner brothers that I've bumbled into. They actually cut that as well, which is ridiculous, but they did. That's a slow method. That's not wise production, is it, really? But you break the rules if it works, I guess. And these guys are crazy. We'll go out on the road and we'll shoot a sequence. And that night, they'll go back to the hotel, tired as anything, and they'll cut a rough. And the next morning at breakfast, I'll be looking at a rough of yesterday's sequence, and it's great. In fact, I know a friend who was filming on Mount Kilimanjaro, and he took an editor along with him, and every night she'd work night shift. She'd sleep all through the day. Every night she'd work. And in the morning, she'd say, that's the sequence that we shot yesterday. And he could see if he needed to go back and do any pickups or anything like that. It was great. Probably got 2 more minutes for another comment or question. When I teach Old Testament studies. But my PhD is in the area of Old Testament narrative, but I apply film theory to it in an attempt to understand the way the narrative is being told. So I actually think that ancient narrative and the kind of stories we try to tell cinematically today have a lot in common, because a good story is a good story. And whether you're telling it to people around a campfire in 1000 BC or writing it on vellum or scribbling it on a Sony camera, some of the principles are the same, I'd argue. The question, will we get the film on secular TV? We hope and pray that we will. In Australia, we've had a very strong interest from one of our major free-to-air broadcaster. And They said, this sounds egotistical, they said the production values are high enough that they might do it. But religion in our country is divisive. Some of the audience will love it, a lot of the audience will hate it and switch channels. So that's the risk, the challenge that you're up against. But I hope we've done it well enough that it might happen in a few countries around the world. But time will tell. Christian channels will be easy. They've already come to us. We've had global Christian satellite networks coming. But in a way, to be honest, that feels like fishing in your own fish tank. I do want Christians to see it, but not yet. Its primary target is lost people, and it's to try to gently thin edge, you know, get the thin edge in the crack and widen from there. Time's up. Thank you for your company, and yeah.